Hello, this is Paul O'Doherty, and you're very welcome to Bookbound. And on this week's programme, my guest is David Wooten, author of The Invention of Science, A New History of the Scientific Revolution, which has just been published by Allen Lane. And later in the programme, Mary O'Brien will join us to review Bill Clegg's Did You Ever Have a Family? But first, David Wooten is Anniversary Professor of History at the University of York. His previous books include Paolo Sarpi, Bad Medicine and Galileo. He has given the Raleigh Lecture at the British Academy, the Carlyle Lectures at Oxford, and the Benedict Lectures at Boston. His latest book is The Invention of Science, A New History of Scientific Revolution. And I'm delighted to say David joins in the programme. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello there.
Can I begin by asking you what life was like prior to the invention of science in the 16th and roughly the 17th century, between 1572 and 1704? And what would the average well-educated person have believed in 1600 that was all about to change?
Well, there are some obvious and straightforward things. They would have all have accepted, or virtually all of them would have accepted, that the Earth stood still at the centre of the universe, that the Sun, the Moon, and all the planets and the stars rotated around the Earth. But they would also, more strikingly, have almost all of them believed in the reality of witchcraft. They would have all of them believed in the almost all of them believed in the effective work of the devil in the world. And they would have all of them have believed in what was called the power of sympathy. A simple example of this is the notion that a human being would be unable to speak in the presence of a wolf because a wolf would naturally terrify a human being. And this was extended to the claim that if you had a drum made of wolf skin and you banged on it, a drum made of sheepskin would immediately become silent in its presence. So there were supposed to be natural antipathies and sympathies at work in the world that had powerful effects upon objects in the world in ways that now seem to us incomprehensible.
The idea that a scientific revolution took place from the 16th century onwards is not a new idea, although it is a controversial one. You make the point that, but for 30 years now, a second generation of historians and philosophers have been attacking the claim that the scientific revolution vastly improved humankind's ability to understand nature. Adapting a relativist perspective, they have been unwilling to acknowledge that Newton was superior to Aristotle or Orsamé, even if only in the sense that his theories made possible better predictions and new types of intervention. Their arguments have convinced almost all anthropologists, nearly every professional historian, and many philosophers, but they are wrong. When was that idea of a scientific revolution first mooted? Why have the following generations not recognized its significance? Why have some willfully neglected it?
Okay, the idea really takes off after the Second World War. Immediately after the Second World War, it's in a sense, it's a response to Hiroshima. Okay. Here has a war that's been won by the power of science, won in the most dreadful and awful fashion by the bombing of Japan. And people start saying, what is science? How has it come to have this power over our lives? What's it the source of our modern type of science? And that leads to a famous book by Herbert Butterfield called The Origins of Modern Science. And everyone starts talking about there being two scientific revolutions, the scientific revolution of Newton and the scientific revolution of Einstein and Rutherford and of relativity and nuclear fission. So that it's essentially a post-Second World War concept which is used to read back into the past the idea of a scientific revolution.
Why have people neglected that, though?
Well, people have neglected it for a very, very simple reason, because they have taken it as a matter of principle that it's wrong to talk about progress. That to talk about progress is to say that our culture is superior to other cultures, and that that's unacceptable if you're a historian or a sociologist or an anthropologist. And so they've taken it as a fundamental matter of principle that you must think in a relativist fashion when you're thinking about other cultures. So they've simply denied the possibility of analyzing, studying, identifying, describing progress. Progress has been excluded from the picture. Now, I would say quite straightforwardly, it's very obvious that science makes progress. It's very obvious that our power to interpret, predict, control nature has radically been transformed over the last few hundred years. Anybody who disputes that, it seems to me, is just not paying attention in any sensible way. I want to say just bonkers. The question is, given that science makes progress, can we understand how it comes to do that? And my book has tries to interpret the way in which science began to become effective at interpreting nature.
We in the 21st century are very familiar with a word such as discovery. But prior to Christopher Columbus, as it were, discovering America in 1492, and for many years after that, there was no words in Latin for the verb to discover. In what ways did this revolution of ideas also require a revolution in language?
In all sorts of ways. You can't make progress, in a sense, unless you want to make progress. Up until 1492, everybody believes that the height of civilization has been in ancient Greece and in ancient Rome. They've inherited the great learning of the past. The main task of the Renaissance is to recuperate knowledge from the past. They turn back to Aristotle, they turn back to Cicero, they turn back to the classical texts and try and discover true knowledge in them. What happens with Columbus is absolutely fundamental, because it turns out that here is a really important knowledge, the knowledge of the existence of the Americas, but also beyond that, the knowledge that the Earth has continents spread right across it, which had been declared impossible through the Middle Ages, Antipodes. That knowledge shows that classical learning is imperfect, and it therefore shows that we can have new knowledge based upon experience, which will transform our understanding of the world. And the word discover is the word that's used as a sort of slogan for that idea. We've made discoveries. We're engaged in voyages of discoveries. And the other key slogan word becomes experience. Knowledge needs to be based upon experience. And so from 1492 onwards, you get people grasping the concept of a new type of knowledge that will be superior to the knowledge of the ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans. And once that concept starts going, there's really no holding it back. It creates a new type of culture, a culture that aspires to acquire new knowledge.
You make the point that the 17th century mathematization of the world was long in preparation. Bearing that in mind, in what way did perspective painting, ballistics, cartography and navigation play in setting the landscape for such people as Galileo, Descartes and Newton?
Well, Galileo, Descartes, Newton, three mathematicians, all of them employed as Descartes studied mathematics. He's not employed by anyone. He's financially self-sufficient. But Galileo, a professor of mathematics, Newton, a professor of mathematics. The leaders of the new science, with almost no exceptions, are mathematicians. And they're in competition with the philosophers. The philosophers teach the philosophy of Aristotle. The new scientists teach the power of mathematics to interpret the world. And it's out of mathematics that the new science grows, because mathematics is an applied form of knowledge. Its foundation in the world of the 16th and 17th century is teaching navigation, teaching perspective painting, teaching the science of gunnery, and so on. So all mathematicians have practical knowledge. They also teach bookkeeping and useful tasks like that. They teach geometry, which is used for surveying and so on. So mathematics is an applied science, and it's out of this applied science that the techniques and skills and attitudes of the new science arise. And crucially, the most powerful of the new science is initially astronomy, which is applied mathematics when it becomes astrology, which is what it always is for essentially through the 16th century.
You mentioned astronomy, and I suppose while Nicholas Copernicus, the Renaissance mathematician and astronomer, who formulated a model that placed the sun rather than the earth at the centre of the universe, had already died by 1543. He is still accredited with triggering the Copernican revolution and making an important contribution to the scientific revolution. What role did Copernicanism play in changing how things were observed into the 17th century?
What I'm essentially arguing in this book, and I'm not the first to argue this, there's some new arguments in the book, but this isn't really a new argument. What I'm essentially arguing is that Copernicus has very little effect. Copernicanism is a fascinating argument to mathematicians in the years after 1543, because it leads to improved, simpler forms of calculation. But almost nobody in the 60 years after 1543 believes that Copernicus is right in thinking that the Earth literally goes around the sun. There's his disciple Rheticus. There's hardly anyone else. There are two or three people in the 1570s and 80s, two or three people in the early 1600s. Everything changes fundamentally with Galileo's use of the telescope, and crucially when Galileo discovers the phases of Venus, which demonstrate that Venus orbits around the sun. And you can show this by looking at the publication of textbooks that lay out classical Ptolemaic astronomy. They're being published continuously without interruption right after Copernicus, even right after Tycho Brahe's great new astronomical works of the 1570s, 1610, 1612, when Galileo publishes his new results, publication of the old astronomy collapses. There's been a revolution in astronomy overnight with the telescope. So where famous philosopher and historian Thomas Kuhn wrote a book called The Copernican Revolution, my argument would be that it's the telescopic revolution that brings about the death of the old astronomy.
You mentioned Tycho Brahe. What's the significance of that Danish nobleman and astronomer seeing that new star in the sky in 1572 and coming to the conclusion that this was proof that the heavens could change?
Right. Well, I mean, there you are. Proof that the heavens could change. Aristotle had insisted there could be no change in the heavens. He knew that there were things called comets. He'd probably seen them himself. Everybody argued that comets existed in the upper atmosphere, somewhere between the Earth and the Moon, that they couldn't possibly be above the Moon because nothing above the Moon ever changed. It always went on exactly the same. In 1572, there's this extraordinary nova, new star, which appears in the sky and which becomes brighter than the planet Venus, becomes even visible in daylight at one for a few days. Tycho Brahe is the first person to record seeing this, and he does very simple measurements which demonstrate that it's up far in the heavens along with the stars, that it's not nearer to the Earth than the Moon. And by doing that, he's demonstrated that a fundamental principle of Aristotelian philosophy and of the astronomy that's based upon it is absolutely wrong. And that's, as it were, the first chink in the armor of Aristotelian philosophy. It's the first moment where Aristotelian philosophy begins to look vulnerable. The next great moment is when Galileo demonstrates that Aristotle's account of motion is completely wrong, of falling bodies is completely wrong, and provides a new account of falling bodies. And after that, and then after the work on the vacuum of people like Pascal and Boyle, the whole of Aristotelian science begins to look as if it's ready to collapse, which is what leads on precisely to the scientific revolution.
We spoke earlier of the scientific revolution also requiring a revolution in language and focused on the need for such words as discovery. Other words also needed to be invented, so to speak, so that they could understand words such as fact, evidence, and experiment. What's the significance of these words, fact, evidence, and experiment?
You can hear me here searching for the right words to talk about this, because this is, I think, the most puzzling and remarkable thing that I'm trying to discuss in my book, and I still have difficulty coming to grips with it. There's early work a few years ago before me which begins to treat the word fact as a new word and grasp that it enters scientific language in the 1660s. And what I've done, because it's easy to do now with computers and the World Wide Web, I've traced the introduction of the word fact into English and shown who first uses it and how it comes into use. And what's crucial here is that if you don't have facts, you can't have what we think of as a science. And before 1660, nobody who's writing about science in English or in French, one or two people in Latin, are using a word that corresponds to the word fact. And I started writing the book with this central idea that I was going to look at the emergence of facts as being the basis of the new science. I'd finished the book. The book was on its way to press. When I woke up, I'd written chapters on words like evidence and experiment and so on. When I suddenly realized that the word theory is a similar word, the first text to be published which uses the word theory in the title is Newton's great experimental work showing that white light is made out of different colored lights by the use of a prism, which is published by the Royal Society in, I guess it's 1672, and the title which is put on it by Oldenburg, who's the editor of the Journal of the Royal Society, is A New Theory of Light and Color. There are no scientific theories before 1672. I don't think you could actually have Newton's theory of gravity unless you've got the idea of a theory, which is something other than a proof or a deduction, but is something which explains all the evidence and makes coherent sense of it. So facts and theories, it seems to me, are the mental building blocks out of which you can construct an idea of what science is, which is something that works, explains things, but can be improved in the light of further evidence. It doesn't stand still. It doesn't stop. It's got progress built into it. And once you've got facts and theories and discovery, you've got the mental building blocks with which you can say, I'm trying to acquire this particular source of knowledge. And before that, you don't have it. So I would say that science is really only possible after 1672 with the emergence of this new vocabulary.
Moving on to another topic in your book, when do scientists start making sense of the laws of nature, effectively no longer giving explanations but also predictions?
Well, again, I mean, this is, again, the new language of the 17th century. The first person to lay real emphasis on the idea of laws of nature is Descartes, and he has three laws of nature, and Newton comes along, and he has three laws of nature in imitation of Descartes. And this is part of, you know, Descartes' laws of nature intended to be mathematical principles that enable you to predict behavior, except they don't, his don't work very well, while Newton's obviously work extremely well. And after that, people start formulating other laws of nature and going back and calling previous discoverers laws of nature. And it's part of the same process whereby names get attached to discoveries. So we talk about Newton's laws of motion, or we talk about Kepler's laws of planetary motion or whatever. These initially aren't named after people. It's only from the mid-17th century onwards that scientific discoveries begin to be named after people, on the model of America being named after Amerigo Vespucci. So science becomes a sort of competition to get things named after you from the mid-17th century onwards. And the laws of nature become the central prize of the new science. Newton himself says the whole purpose of science is to discover new laws of nature. So that the laws of nature are the ultimate theoretical achievement of the new science. There's no thinking like that before the middle of the 17th century.
And during the middle of the 17th century, what was the reaction to these new ideas?
Well, until Newton is widely accepted, which isn't until the 1750s, essentially, Aristotelian philosophy goes on being taught in most of the universities of Europe without much of a problem. Holland is an exception, where they switch over to Cartesian philosophy in the late 17th, early 18th century. But fundamentally, the philosophers remain Aristotelians until well into the 18th century. And where they're not Aristotelians, they're Cartesians. It's only with the triumph of Newtonianism by the middle of the 18th century that it becomes clear that the new science can't be refuted and has to be accepted. And that's the moment, for example, at which the Catholic Church turns around and accepts that the sun is at the center of the solar system and that the earth goes around the sun, because it recognizes that the triumph of Newton is incontestable. And if Newton is right, then Copernicus has to be right. Ultimate success of Newton, which takes 60 or 70 years, the ultimate success of Newton, which brings with it the success of Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and everyone who'd gone before, who up until that point have been still open to attack. So right into the 1650s, the best astronomers are rejecting Copernicanism, and right into the early 18th century, the French are rejecting Newton and insisting that the Newtonian principles are completely false, because all action has to involve direct contact between objects, and so you can't have gravity operating at a distance. They reject that as a sort of magical notion. So it's Newton who brings about the sense that the new science can't be overturned.
In the last part of your book, you explore the scientific origins of the Industrial Revolution. Listeners, I suppose, will already know that the Industrial Revolution was this transition from the land into the factories that began from about 1760, somewhere between 1820 and 1840. This transition included, I suppose, innovations in production methods, the arrival of machines, chemical manufacturing, and all that sort of thing. Have the dates of the origins of the scientific revolution vis-a-vis the Industrial Revolution shifted according to your research?
Yes. I mean, a standard line that used to be taken by the generation of scholars that came after Butterfield from 1946 through into the 1960s and 70s and early 80s, the generation who believed that there was a scientific revolution and that we could study the scientific revolution, that generation said there was no real connection between the scientific revolution and the Industrial Revolution. They said that Boyle and Newton and so on had all these brilliant ideas, but none of them had had any ideas that were relevant to the steam engine, which was the driving force of the Industrial Revolution, and to a real mastery over nature. Now, one of the things I've tried to argue in the book, the first person who builds a working steam engine is Newcomen in 1721. What I argue in the book is that it's always been a mystery where Newcomen, who was relatively uneducated, got his ideas for his steam engine from. What was his source of information? I argue that it's a book published by a man called Denis Papin, who was a French exile from France, a Huguenot, who'd escaped the persecution of Catholics in France, came to England, who worked with Robert Boyle, who was Robert Boyle's right-hand man and assistant for many years. And Papin set out to build a steam engine, went to work in Germany for a few years, and fell on hard times. But Papin published in an early work in England a description of the project of building a steam engine, which I think Newcomen must have read and enabled Newcomen to understand the principles of work. So I think there's an absolutely direct link between the Royal Society, which employed Papin as an experimentalist, and the invention of the steam engine, and thus a direct link between the scientific revolution and the industrial revolution, which is precisely what you'd expect. You'd expect the new science to pay off in terms of greater control over nature. And the fundamental principle at work here, after all, was Boyle's law, which explains how pressures can create forces. And Boyle's law is precisely something that Papin had worked on discovering with Boyle.
David Wooten, you've written a fascinating history of the period. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
A pleasure talking to you. Bye.
Goodbye. The Invention of Science, A New History of the Scientific Revolution is published by Alan Lane. And that's a fascinating, really well-researched book on the history of science that's sure to become a standard in the years to come. And the ideal companion for anyone looking for a late autumn, early winter read to get stuck into by a warm fire, the like. It's also a controversial read in that it challenges a lot of the views of modern historians.